This on and say today is November 29th, 2018, and Karen Brewster here again with Kathleen Mike Dalton at her home in Fairbanks, and her daughter Libby is here in and out, just finishing up making some tea.
And the dog. Which barks.
Well, we hope the dog won't bark.
Isabella. Izzy for short.
Okay. Yes, and we hear her walking around with her.
Izzy is a Chesapeake Retriever.
Mm-hmm. And she's a very good watchdog.
Yes.
Okay, so as you said last week, I asked you about the issue of navigable waters. And that somebody had told me that you might have been involved in that issue at some point. Now, I don't know if that's correct or not.
That's correct. Well, the RS-2477 issue is a statute, and it involved navigable waters, because when we became a state, the Organic Act, Statehood Act, granted the state of Alaska certain navigable, certain assets. For example, the former Copper River Railroad, which was built by the federal government, it went from Chitna in the McCarthy area to Cordova. When we became a state, we were granted that right of way. Most people don't know that.
I didn't know that.
Another right of way that was granted in the same act, Statehood Act, was a right of way from Manly to Tanana.
Okay. So is that like the Tofty, what is called the Tofty Road?
I don't know what it's called.
Okay.
But people got really excited about that. Had no idea that we owned the right-of-way. Mm-hmm. And so a road was built there. And they didn't have to go fight the feds for the right-of-way because we already owned it.
Yeah, I know just recently, was it last year they opened up a road from Manly to the Yukon River.
And across from Tanana.
Yeah, be on that right-of-way.
It also granted the state of Alaska the right of ownership of every navigable stream in Alaska. That includes every navigable river, stream, and lakes. So the streams that early prospectors used to navigate from point A to point B, and point C and D in between, on their treks. And a stream may be small, as long as it's navigable, and it may be large, like the Yukon, which is massive.
Mm-hmm.
there at the bridge. I like to go to that bridge and just look at the river and
yeah.
try to calculate how many barrels of water are running by us. And then go on down to Mulatto and Ruby and Galena. Sometimes you could barely see the other side of the river. It's so huge.
Yeah.
It's a huge asset.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you get out to the mouth, or even at Circle, where several rivers could come in and join the Yukon, Tanana, and all the rivers that join the Tanana, you know, like the Black River and the I don't know, I'd have to have a map in front of me to
the Good Pasture, maybe?
Oh yeah, everything
the
between
Delta, yeah.
Everything between
the Nanana.
Tanana, which receives hundreds of streams, creeks and streams. And then the farther down you go, the more that flow into it, like the Koyukuk is a major distributor or addition to the Yukon.
Yeah.
And then all of those big rivers that go down, flow into the Yukon. Pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm. And we won't go into all the detailed definitions and legal issues, but it's been a big legal fight between the state and the federal government over what is navigable, right?
Yeah. Of course, Good Pasture and Salser rivers are not navigable for a huge stern wheeler, but they're navigable for smaller vessels. Oh yeah, it's been a constant battle after statehood.
Mm-hmm.
But most people don't know that because they haven't followed the debate.
Yeah, and the ANILCA, the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act in 1980, it dealt with some navigable water definitions that I think complicated it.
I don't know. I haven't really studied the 1980 Act. I know it created a lot of headaches after it was passed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. It seems that the state and the feds have different ideas of what is navigable and they're going by different laws. But we won't get into all that. That's very complicated. But so what has been your role? Were you involved in this issue?
I was from several people, you know, in territorial days who were debating that issue. And I remember I was not active in it, but I knew about it. I was involved with the Fairbanks Native Association, was very active in it. And I was a member of the Native Association. I was made an honorary member in 1965 of Fairbanks Native Association. But I've never belonged to any of the larger organizations.
Mm-hmm.
It was a major issue for the newspaper. I worked for the News Miner from 1961 to 1978.
No, 71.
78.
You worked for the newspaper for 10 years.
Yeah.
Because you went to work for Stevens after that, right?
I went to work for the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. It was 1961.
Yeah, well, and you had told me before you started working for Stevens in 72. So
it was 61 to 71.
61 to 71 was with the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, anyway, it was a major issue for the newspaper.
I knew about it, but I was not involved. Either preliminary debates that they were having. But I knew most of the people who were.
Mm-hmm.
And the earliest one was a man named William Paul from southeastern Alaska. He had been involved in it for many years from southeastern, but he was a leader in the issue. And it came to my house one night. We sat around this room like this, probably 10 people talking about it. He had a son named William Paul. But the senior was active in it for many years. He was a college graduate, and I think his son was also. His son was a legislator, I believe.
Was he a lawyer, or was that his son?
His son, and William Paul was one of the first Tlingit lawyers. He's a very bright man.
Yeah, I've heard his name.
Very bright man. Took big leadership roles. And he knew a lot about the issues. He knew a lot about Native land clans that had been started decades ago. It was a pleasure to listen to him because he was so informed.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of what he said was originated in his law office. I'm sorry, I'm kind of hesitant on this because I don't know much about what work William Paul actually accomplished.
That's okay. You just know. Tell me what your experience and what you know. The other stuff can be filled in by somebody else.
Well, I'm sure there's a lot written about William Paul.
Yeah, see, I've heard his name, and I think it's in connection with land issues.
Another man named Wardridge. I think his first name was John, who was very active in the issue in the Tlingit and Haida area.
What was his last name again?
Wardridge.
Okay. And was he a Tlingit or Haida?
I think he was Tlingit.
Okay.
I'm not sure about that. I know that there are many paragraphs written about both of those men.
Yeah.
So then as the time went by and the 1980 land claims approached, there were a lot of people involved, and they came up to Fairbanks to help organize or join the organization efforts up here. And the ones I remember early on were Don Wright, Mary Jane Fate, and Gerald Ivey. And others. I didn't work with them. I wasn't a member of their committees. I got involved somewhat because I would write news stories about what was happening. And that's why I got involved with Fairbanks Native Association, is that they had no organization. They had no office. They had no officers. They had no structure. Mm-hmm. And like some other organizations in Fairbanks, you know, they were working hard to organize their issue or issues. And they had little or no publicity, mostly no publicity. Mm-hmm. So since I had lived on the Navajo reservation, now called Navajo Nation, and having lived with Navajos, and having witnessed the conditions that they forever they've lived under, I became interested in that. When I worked for them first, they were located on 2nd Avenue in Fairbanks, in the Lathrop Building, and across the street was the Nordale Hotel, which housed hotel guests, of course. It also housed John Butrovich's insurance office, and they housed Pan American Airlines. And I'm not sure what else. The city hostess, Eva McGowan, had a space in there. Mm-hmm. And one of the people involved with Native land claims and related issues was Ralph Perdue. He had a little jewelry shop. Worked mostly in gold. And Ralph was from Koyukuk. He was adopted by a couple, Mr. and Mrs. Perdue of North Pole. They'd lived in this area a long time. They did not live in Koyukuk, mm-hmm. but they adopted Ralph, which is a common practice among the Athabascans to adopt a baby or a young boy as their own child. It's a very common practice. Mm-hmm. And Ralph was educated by this couple. And wherever he went to get educated, he found out about being a jeweler. Mm-hmm. He was a very accomplished gold nugget.
Yeah, I remember his shop in the old Shoppers Forum mall in the later years.
Yeah, his wife, Dorothy, manned the shop after Ralph died. At any rate, Ralph was real interested in this issue. And he, because he had been adopted by a white couple, North Pole, he'd associated a lot with white people. He'd been exposed to our educational system. He went out to Mount Edgecombe High School. I think it was Mount Edgecombe. And was pretty well educated. Of course, when people like William Paul came to town, Ralph would be meeting with him. They'd be talking about, what are we going to do? We're going to do it like the Indians in Arizona or Oklahoma. And so I got to know Ralph, and I had a lot of talks on that. And I said, no, don't go the way they do in Arizona. They live on they sleep on the dirt floor of their hogans. They're just wards of the government. Mm-hmm. They don't have any structural basis. And another person whom I met, I had met him through other friends, was the artist Rusty Herleen. And Rusty was a good friend of Ralph's and guided him on certain aspects of the claims issue. And I don't know where Rusty got his education on how Indians were treated in the South 48 states, but he knew a lot about it. But his history was that he left the East Coast, Bedford, Maine, landed in the United States. He was born in Sweden. And he came to the United States as a young man. And he made his way to the West Coast. And I know that he, I'm not sure where he stopped and acquainted himself with U.S. citizens, but I know that he worked his way west and he spent some time in Texas. And I'm thinking that he spent some time in some of the native reservations coming west. Mm-hmm. And he had a lot of friends there. But he advocated with the native people. He was very bright. He studied the issues very carefully. And he and Ralph are good friends, so he recommended that the local native groups not follow the policy that the United States government had set for Navajos and Comanches and Pimas and
so the Indian reservation system.
He saw firsthand the natives. Well, I saw firsthand the native situation too. Not good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Rusty and I and Ralph and his wife became good friends. And Ralph's position was anti-reservation. I think he picked up some of his proof of some of the negative aspects of it from Rusty and from me. Mm-hmm. And he had a lot of friends, so I can't say that I was influential with him, but I was, because I told him, I just gave him examples of what I knew from growing up from a 5 or 6 year old kid. I've been to their snake dances, lived near their school. One interesting thing, this one Indian well, it wasn't a town, it was an agency. The Bureau of Indian Affairs would set up some kind of an agency where they would be a headquarters, kind of an organization, give them some kind of a structure and organization. And I remember the first one I remember was called LEUPPE. That's up near Winslow.
In Arizona?
Arizona. Now, I can remember, it just as a little kid, I don't know how old I was, must have been 4 or 5. My parents had taught me the Lord's Prayer. So I was, one day I was on across town from where I lived, near their school. And they were having lunch. They all were housed in a dormitory, maybe the boys in one, the girls another, and they all went together to lunch or dinner. So this is at lunchtime, and everybody stopped eating, and they recited the Pledge of Allegiance. I didn't know that. I remember hearing it. And then they would said the Lord's Prayer. Now, I know I went home and told my mother about it. They were, said that they were saying our prayer, which is unusual. But that was a policy of the Interior Secretary then was Ickes. That was the policy then.
Harold Ickes.
That they prayed.
Yeah. It was part of the policy of assimilation, probably, that Native people were supposed to become like non-Native people.
Yeah. They wanted everybody to be Christians. Mm-hmm. Well, nobody made any issue out with it, but that's one of my first memories there at Loop. Mm.
And so why were you at Loop? Was your father...
My father worked for the BIA.
Oh, right, okay.
He was a contractor and worked as a maintenance man and construction person.
Okay. So let's get us back to Alaska. It was from those experiences when you were a girl... That you didn't want to see reservations here in Alaska?
Oh, no, I didn't want to see reservations. The people were, they were not free. They didn't own their houses. Who wanted to own a hogan? It was just a round structure made of logs and mud. They slept inside, had a fire in the middle, and a hole on top. That's where the... I mean, it was pretty primitive and dirty. They didn't have beds. They didn't even have beds. They just had Navajo rugs on the ground.
Yeah.
So
that's how they had lived for generations.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I described it all to Ralph. And he said, well, I've seen pictures of that. I said, well, you don't want to see that in Alaska. And I don't know what direction to... The conversations were between Rusty and Ralph. But Ralph was very influential in the local organization. Mm-hmm. He had this shop in downtown Fairbanks. He was a person of some education, and people from Koyukuk and Nulato and Ruby and other villages in that area come in. And here he is. Dressed up like a white man, lived like a white man, worked like a white man. You saw all that gold jewelry there.
Yeah.
So people opened their eyes on that. And he was educated to a certain degree.
So was there a connection between the Native land claims and this question of navigable waters? Were they dealing with that issue?
Well, that was part of the debate that they wanted to close off. That was one of the big questions they asked each other. Will they close off the Koyukuk and the I was not... an active participant in their debates. You know, they go from maybe from Koyukuk down to downriver or upriver to Galena, or this village has sent a delegation. upriver. They discuss what's the issue up here. Well, it's subsistence hunting fish or moose. Who gets all the moose up? That's our river. You know, that Koyukuk is my river. Mm-hmm. The Yukon, you know, they realized the Yukon was massive and everybody could claim a bucket of water out of that. Then the upriver people would associate with downriver people. They were all the same tribe.
Yeah.
Athabascan. That's what surprised me about the Russian Far East, the natives over there. For example, in that painting behind you are three dancers.
Mm-hmm.
They're Koyukuk dancers. Or not Koyukuk, but...
Koryuk?
Koryuk,
in the Russian Far East. Koryuk
dancers. And I have a drum in another room, which is a Koryuk dancing drum. And they look just like the Athabascans over here.
Mm-hmm.
Those in that picture are from Lower Kamchatka. But the ones up near Magadan look as though they just came over from Alaska.
So have you been to the Russian Far East?
Mm-hmm, yes.
When did you go there and why?
I went there in 1991 with a group from Unalaska. We were a white people delegation. It was still USSR then.
Mm-hmm.
1991, and we went over from Unalaska because it was, it's a major fishing community on the east side of the Bering.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first time a group of whites had gone over. We got permission from the USSR to go visit. We did.
So did you fly with Aeroflot?
We flew from Anchorage to Magadan and took some exchange gifts, mostly fresh fruit and vegetables, and some artwork.
So what was the purpose of going? The
purpose of going was getting to know some of our neighbors over on the Russian East Coast.
Weren't you like sister cities?
Hmm?
Weren't you sister cities?
Unalaska was a sister city, or Fairbanks was?
No, Fairbanks had a sister city, but Unalaska didn't have a sister city.
Oh.
They might have later, but not when we went. Anyway, there was a group of about 55 people from Unalaska went over. A lot of them were associated with the fishing industry. And others were, some people from Juneau and Ketchikan and Yakutat. Scattered people from the coastal area down mm-hmm. there who were also associated with in fishing. And we gathered in Anchorage. We all paid our own way on Alaska Airlines, flew from Anchorage over to Magadan, and from Magadan down to Petropavlovsk, which is down near the south tip of Kamchatka mm-hmm. Peninsula.
Now, were you living in Unalaska at the time? That's why.
Yes,
you...
I was. I moved over there, and I had a job with the city of Unalaska. So I was very involved in the organization of the trip.
Mm-hmm.
was pretty exciting.
Yeah.
And they had what they called hotels. They're pretty rough.
The way you just raised your eyebrows, I can see, like, air quotes, hotels. They were kind of like a hotel.
Kind of like a hotel.
But
yeah.
Not the...
I remember the bridge, the bed I had in my hotel room was very rudimentary, crude. Just had 1x4 around the edge and a thin mattress. Yeah. Pretty lumpy. Very lumpy mattress.
So I've heard about the Friendship flight.
It's similar to that.
This one was after that?
Before.
Before.
Yeah, we did probably had one of the first Friendship flights.
Yeah, I can't remember the year of the one they call the Friendship flight.
But our trip was in 1991.
Yeah. So whose idea was this trip? Was it your idea?
It wasn't my idea. Somebody else was dealing in art. And in Russia, the artists are assigned to be an artist, or a teacher is assigned early on. You go to this class, you go to that school, you'll be a teacher. They'll choose her. I know we had an art exchange trip later, and the man who painted that, I paid $500 for that. He couldn't believe it. You know, we bought all the ones I brought from Russia.
So this one you bought from Russia, you brought it back with you.
Mm-hmm. Oh. They had never had an art show. They didn't know what an art gallery was. Mm-hmm. They had an idea because when they were assigned to be an artist, they went to that building over there and put their paintings up. But they never conceived of getting any money for it. Mm-hmm. That was just his job.
Yeah, well, and $500 was probably huge amount of money.
Yeah, it was a huge amount of money.
Yeah. And what's this other one?
That one's
the ocean scene.
Seashore.
That's very dramatic.
Up really. Trying to think of the name of the... this big seaport on the East Coast.
But Okhotsk? No. I don't know the geography there. But it looks like there's a ship. Is that a shipwreck or it's just an old ship?
No, there's no... No, it's just a...
Just a ship.
Seashore.
Yeah.
It's so stormy. It looks so real.
Yeah.
It's so dramatic.
It reminds me a little bit of Winslow Homer. Stormy Seas of New England that he used to paint.
Who?
Winslow Homer.
Sidney Lawrence painted a lot of
seashore. Mm-hmm. So what else, when you were over there in Petropavlovsk, what kind of things did you do? How long were you there?
Well, we were there about a week. We had a big reception. And put out a lot of fresh fruit and hors d'oeuvres, things I had never seen before.
Yeah.
And I remember we had all kinds of fancy crackers. We also had soda crackers, which is kind of the rudimentary cracker in the United States. But they liked them. They'd never had them like ours. I remember seeing one man, he was very well dressed, which was unusual, and he'd been eating some hors d'oeuvres with soda crackers. And I saw him take just one soda cracker and eat it, and he took the whole sleeve, stuck it in his pocket.
So like saltine crackers? What do you mean? Soda crackers, I think, is little
things. Saltines.
Saltines. Did you take pilot bread?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We had pilot bread, and we had bananas and oranges, and apples, and any kind of fresh fruit we could get.
And then did you visit other organizations? And other towns?
They had some art groups, yeah. And they had schools that they invited us to go visit. And other public events.
Mm-hmm.
Can't remember now.
Did you go other places besides Petropavlovsk?
Did I go where?
Did you visit other towns or villages?
No, we didn't visit any villages, but we stayed there for close to a week. We took a cruise. They took us on a cruise ship, which to them was very... It was one of their more elaborate attractions in the harbor. But we thought it was fine, but it was pretty rudimentary ship. See, we went to Petropavlovsk, Khabarovsk, and Vladivostok.
Mm.
It's where that was.
It's where
the shore.
The shoreline, Vladivostok.
What's his name? Gorbachev.
Mm-hmm.
He called Vladivostok Russia's San Francisco. And that's what it looked like. It was a beautiful city. And they had a couple of churches. They made sure we saw their Russian Orthodox churches because they wanted us to know that they had churches.
Even though the Soviet government didn't really want people going to church.
No, they didn't want them. No, they were just barely opening up some of their churches.
Yeah.
And we went to some clinics. It was pretty bad.
Mm.
They had little or no medical assistance. They took us to a grocery store. Shelves were empty. I mean empty. Couldn't even buy a loaf of bread.
Yeah. So how were the people surviving?
I don't know. They were surviving. They looked somewhat healthy. Not real healthy, but somewhat healthy. But they were very polite. Very happy to meet some Americans. One thing people did when they went over that, they would exchange lapels.
Mm-hmm. Lapel pins.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wore a Caterpillar tractor hat that said cat.
Uh-huh.
I exchanged it for a Russian hat. A man took his hat off. He pointed my hat. Took his hat off and gave it to me. I've got it there in the closet. Cat hat was very popular.
Mm-hmm.
Some American.
Yeah.
Me American.
Yep.
It was an odd visit. It was just, we had never seen, wasn't middle class, it was lower class. The living conditions were, they had a lot of apartment buildings that were real crude, but they were 6 or 7 or 8 stories high. They were pretty rough construction. Anyway, we got an eyeful. The reason we went on that is that some of the Russians had been coming over in their little yachts. They call them yachts. They were 28-foot sailing vessels. And they'd been coming over from Petropavlovsk to Unalaska for several years, and you go out there and cross the Bering Sea.
Wow.
And after our trip, more of them came. They took their lives in their own hands. It was incredible what they did. They were about 28 feet, most of 28 feet to 30 feet.
Now, were they coming over to escape and to get asylum in the
U.S.?
They were
going around the world. They wanted out of Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back the next year with a couple of friends of mine. And there must have been 7 or 8 yachts came over while we were there. And they just got in these yachts and had their own goals, going around the world mostly. They didn't speak anything but Russian.
Well, they must have been somewhat wealthy to be able to afford a boat like that.
I don't know how they did it.
So the next trip you made with friends, was that your Arctic Sisterhood gals?
Got what?
Your Arctic Sisterhood. Is that who you went with
the
second time?
The next year, my two friends from Fairbanks came over, and 3 of us, that was one of our adventures. I forgot to mention that to you the other day. The Arctic Sisterhood.
Yeah, we were talking about the Arctic Sisterhood, but we didn't get to that you went to the Soviet Far East with them.
Yeah. This one lady, Mrs. Stepovich, found out that I had gone to Russia with people from Unalaska, and she wanted to go, so she contacted me and said, "Vel, if you go, I go." So I said, "Okay." But we didn't go with a big group. We just went by ourselves. Went to Magadan. That's where I noticed the resemblance in the Alaskan Athabascans and the Koyukuk.
Mm-hmm.
Koryak
mm-hmm.
tribe. Yeah, they came over the next year. We had a really good trip. They were a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
It was a crazy thing to do, but
it was pretty early to do that.
Yeah, Russia opened its doors in 92, I think. But the year before, the trip that we made from Unalaska to Petropavlovsk in Magadan was the first time an American group had been there, ever been in that country.
Wow.
They had never seen an American before. Mm-hmm. Kind of surprised to see that we looked pretty much like the Russians, better dressed, better hats, better shoes. So a lot of good relations were created in that trip.
So when you went with your friends, was that with Vuka Stepovich?
Vuka Stepovich. I said, "Why do you want to go to Russia? You lived over here for 50 years in America, never went back to Yugoslavia." She wanted to go see the Russian Trans-Siberian
Railroad.
Hmm. I said, "Where'd you hear about that?" Well, she said when she was growing up in Yugoslavia, a lot of people went on it. Mm-hmm. She didn't, but she did. She'd been hearing about that all her life. She said, I want to go on the Trans-Siberian Railroad. I said, "Okay, we'll go over there. We'll go on the Trans-Siberian Railroad." And we did.
So you did go on the railroad?
Yeah, we did.
Oh, cool.
So she and I were it was a group of two.
So your other Arctic Sisterhood gals didn't go? It was just you and
no,
Vuka?
No, just Vuka and I.
Oh. So you went to Magadan?
We flew out of Anchorage to Magadan, then over south to Khabarovsk.
Mm-hmm.
Got on the railroad there. And that just follows the Mongolian, Russia-Mongolian border on out to Vladivostok, to the coast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She spoke, her Russian was close enough in some cases to be understood.
Mm-hmm. So did you take the railroad all the way to Moscow? The way across?
No, we didn't. We took the railroad, went by Alaska Airlines to Magadan and then south to Khabarovsk. Mm-hmm. And actually, that's where that painting came from.
Mm-hmm.
But I bought that painting, a couple other things. And in Magadan, this was 1992, was the year after it opened to foreigners. So we went, took a little tour of the town and found somebody who would give us a play. We were tourists, you know, they didn't know about tourists. They looked at us, you know, like we were something odd. We were tourists. But her Russian was close enough for them to understand basic Russian.
Yeah.
And we spent time in Magadan. She wanted to see their church just opened. That was her main interest, was the Orthodox Church, what was going on. So we went up to this north of Magadan. They had this church. The villagers were rebuilding the church. And while we're there, the priest came, and she talked with him. And she opened up her wallet and took out $100 bill and gave it to the priest. And he practically melted on the spot. He couldn't believe he's got $100 American currency. It was very touching.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was just very, very touched. Didn't mean anything to her.
Right.
She wanted to make sure that he was for his church.
Yeah.
So it was to me it was a very moving incident.
Yeah.
We stayed there. A friend of mine in Unalaska had been over. And she located several people in Magadan and Khabarovsk and over in Vladivostok and told them that there should be a B&B. What's a B&B?
Mm-hmm.
So we had a place to stay in Magadan and Khabarovsk. We were tourists.
Right.
Introducing the bed and breakfast concept.
Yep.
And that's what we did. We just stayed with private people.
Wow, neat. What an experience.
Real, yeah. In Vladivostok, it was July. It was hot, really hot. I was wearing a denim dress. I wore it every day, and it was getting kind of dirty, so I washed it, hung it up to dry. It wouldn't dry because the atmosphere was so wet.
Oh, it was humid.
Yeah, so humid and hot. Yeah. Took days for that to dry out enough to wear again.
You think you just put it on, it would dry right on you.
That's what I did eventually, put it on.
Yeah.
Because it wouldn't dry hanging up.
Too heavy fabric. Yeah.
But that's the most money we spent. When she gave that $100 bill to the priest. It was very moving to me.
Well, you say people weren't used to having tourists and Americans. They probably just wanted to host you and do nice things for you. They were happy to have visitors. Well, I got us off track on the navigable waters question. Because once you said you went on that trip, I was curious to know more about it. But we got off track on the navigable waters issue.
Well, that was one of the major issues of land claims. But the major issue was the D2 lands.
Mm-hmm.
And they were called the D2 lands and the 80 legislation. And it was written so they would not take action in 1980. They would take action later. This came about in...
Yeah, they're called D2 lands because that was the section in the bill. It was Section D2 that addressed those.
It was for the navigable streams.
Izzy's barking. But yeah, it's still...
My dog, Izzy, is barking at something.
Yeah, something.
Probably a raven flying around. It's dark outside.
Yeah.
Or if somebody drives up the driveway.
But you say that navigable water started with statehood in 1959, and now 2018, there's still... court cases about it, and they're still...
It'll be in the courts forever.
Yeah. But so you reported on it when you worked for the News Miner?
Yes. The D2 section of the lands claim didn't set aside 20 million acres for the Inupiat or another 10 or 15 million. For the Athabascans, they just made arrangements for the Congress to come back and consider that, consider what kind of lands would be granted to the Inupiat, how many and where. Other issues cropped up in that, which were navigable waters, and subsistence issues. These all can be broken down into various issues.
Yeah, and very complicated and long, still fought over issues, for sure.
Yeah, then the native corporations or the native groups organized many study groups. The environmentalists organized many study groups. The fisheries people were very involved because navigable streams affected them pretty seriously. So there were native groups in, you know, Yakutat and Cordova and Juneau and Ketchikan, Fairbanks, Anchorage, wherever there was an native organization active, woke up real fast. There were a lot of conferences. A lot of conferences over the years. Couldn't keep up with it.
Was there any consensus amongst, like, the native groups?
No.
Because I know they've had a different perspective probably than the environmental groups.
Oh, yeah. Environmental groups didn't want any open lands in the Arctic. They fought that fiercely. Still are.
So after you said you had this meeting here in your house with William Paul and I guess Ralph Perdue. So were you involved in helping them? What did you do?
They would invite me to their meetings and report on it.
So you kind of helped with their publicity by writing articles?
Yes. Okay. Indeed. Fairbanks Native Association had no publicity at first. Then they began to invite me. So one weekend they decided they're going to have a big meeting here in Fairbanks. They're going to have a potlatch so people come. So they had a big potlatch. And they invited me, and I said, well, what do you want? I wasn't into salmon or muktuk. So I made my turkey roaster full of beans. So every time they'd have a potlatch after that, I was the bean lady. So I went to a lot of those. They're just organizing meetings. Mm-hmm. So in 1965, when they had a potlatch, well, then the commander, not commander, but the enlisted, the person who was the MC in the meeting called me and two others up, and then two or three other native people, and they gave us a little plaque thanking us for our help and their efforts.
That's nice.
I guess they didn't know I was full-blooded Irish. But I had worked with them quite a bit.
Yeah. Well, I'd say some sort of an honor to be involved with their efforts as a non-native.
Mm-hmm. There was some similarity because they would build houses out of logs and use mud for caulking. But they didn't sleep on a dirt floor.
Not so, by then, but yeah.
So talk about when you worked down with Doug Blankenship and Tinker and all those guys developing your historical trails to include in the RS-2477. That's the meat of this thing.
Okay.
Yeah,
there was a task put out.
Another major section of that 1980 Native Claims Act was the access, not navigable waters, but added to navigable waters, was access across lands.
Historic routes and trails.
That's RS-2477, or historic routes and trails.
Yeah.
Right.
And what does, and if there is one, we you put were on allowed a, to have access.
You had to identify every one of them.
Yeah, I was working at the time for Lieutenant Governor Jack Coghill, and he's the father of the RS-2477 success in Alaska.
So you had to document every one of those trails?
Mm-hmm. It had been an issue that he followed all the way through from the beginning of discussion on it. And when I worked for him in Juneau, he wanted me to do nothing but that. Well, there's no way I was just a staff person for him. And I could put together a case report on various issues. RS-247, it was in one big issue, one big trail would be maybe 15 other issues. And we were trying to do that in his office there in Juneau. And I finally told him, I can't do that. There's no way I need help because there's just no way I can do it in this little office.
It's too massive of a project.
Yeah. There were so many trails documented, right?
And Governor Hickel was governor, and our chief of staff in that office was Don I'll think of his name in a minute, from McGrath. And he and the chief of staff and Jack and Governor Hickel would get together in their governor's office from time to time, discussing what we needed to do. And so finally, one day, Governor Hickel was walking down the hallway with Don, and Don had a chance to tell him what we were trying to do. And Hickel said, "How much do you need?" Don Harris, he'd been a legislator with Jack and had been working this issue for a long time, understood it real well, was able to articulate it well to the governor. So they're walking down the hallway, and Governor Hickel said, "Well, how much do you need? I'll see if I can get the legislature to..." He said, "We probably need $800,000. So Hickel said, "Okay, I'll ask for it." And by golly, we got it.
Wow.
From the legislature.
Well, so then the attorneys got involved, because the attorneys knew how to navigate it to get it into statute, mm-hmm. right?
Right. Well, I moved from Fairbanks to Fairbanks, and then we built a crew up here to do what we needed to do.
And it was it in the AG's office? Is that where your office was?
No, my office was then transferred to Department of Natural Resources in Fairbanks, and we picked up people who had worked in lands in the Department of Natural Resources and in the highway. The highways had done something on it. Fortunately, there were a couple of highway employees over the years who had noticed that this thing really was flying off it was not being attended to.
Mm-hmm.
So we put them on my crew. And we had about 15 people here in Fairbanks, 15 to 20 sometimes. And our assignment was to identify RS-2477 trails and rights of way. And that's where the navigable streams came in, because they were RS-2477.
Okay. Well, was it just for this region, or was it for the whole state of Alaska?
Just for the whole state.
Good grief.
And to identify sounds like, oh, that's not a big deal, but you had to research the history, and you had to prove that it was.
To prove legally that it had been used, so we used people to research the common routes that were used in Alaska. Either my dog team or canoe or overland prospectors walking.
Mm-hmm.
We ended up with 800 and some. I haven't reviewed this for a long time. So we identified 800 and some RS-2477 trails. That means some of them started in Barrow and went to Anaktuvik and
mm-hmm.
various other places.
How did you get the word out to all the regions to submit?
To people submitted ideas or suggestions?
People were interested in it. The Miners Association was very interested in it, because they had no access to their mining properties.
Right.
And, one miner would go into the BLM, get turned away or arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd find out about that, and his neighbor would let us know, or he just spread the word.
Well, how'd you get the word out to Southeast Alaska and to South Central Alaska?
Did you have community meetings or kind
yeah,
of?
Yeah, we had some meetings. DNR had its own budget for travel. We had a budget for travel. We looked at various maps and logical routes from A to B to C to D. Then we try to find something that would back that up. Like in the early USGS journals. Then there was a lady, a friend of mine. She belonged to the Pioneers of Alaska. And I knew that she had come to Fairbanks in 1927 by dog team from Flat. Well, you know, I said, well, I can give you a person who actually came here by dog team from Flat. So we started asking around, and we found a map or two, showed some of the major trails, and then we talked to Senator Ted Stevens about getting any maps that showed early trails. And he contacted the the early USGS maps. And they went through their department, and with Senator Stevens' influence, they sent us every map they had that showed a trail on it. Major trail.
Wow.
That was a huge find.
Well, it's a huge project.
Yeah. Oh, it was. We ended up with close to 800 with established trails that we could prove by USGS maps or mining maps or just a story and say the Gnome Nugget, for example. It'd be a story about Joe Blow from such and such a place coming across land. So then we go look someplace else to get some more documentation of that route.
Well, and also, as you said, somebody's journal who maybe wrote down, this is the way I went.
Exactly. The newspapers were very helpful. We'd find out that Joe Blow had come in, and in order to get there, he had to come by dog team.
So Doug Blankenship was involved because he was an attorney in the AAG's office for Department of Natural Resources. He did resources.
We had a couple of attorneys from the Attorney General's office to help us with some of the legal problems, a lot of legal problems.
Like what kind of legal problems?
Well, people would contest what we had, so we get him to track it down
and figure out if it met the qualifications for historical.
Yeah, you have to lay out the origin, the terminus. You have to get some documentation on that, or written. Or oral, had a lot of oral.
You have to have evidence.
You have to have evidence.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, so why was this important to have these trails identified and documented?
It was important because some gold miner or prospector in the 40-mile area, for example, wanted to go back to a certain gold prospect on the 40-mile river that had been prospected and identified 45 years ago. Major trail from here to here, there to there, there to here.
It was important for...
So they may have used it in the past, but now the federal government or...
Said, no, you can't do that.
Okay, so the state wanted to allow people that access and to prove that they could have that access.
They had the legal right to use that.
But that, not just mining.
No.
Hunting, fishing, trapping, fishing?
Yeah. Subsistence, whatever.
Just recreational purposes.
Yeah.
Access to land.
To, yeah.
access to mining properties, mm-hmm. to fishing properties.
Well, you said something about the making it a statute. So that was into the state statutes?
It's now codified. They're all codified.
All of those 800 officially codified.
Senator Rick Halford mm-hmm. from Chugiak was very interested, and he was very helpful. So finally we got our final list. He took it and wrote it into a bill.
Okay.
So it's now codified.
That says those specific trails mm-hmm. have to be recognized.
Yes.
Okay.
And I don't know the exact number, but I think...
Libby, you said Doug Blankenship and Tinker.
Was Mike Tinker involved in that?
He was on research, yes. Very
involved. He was involved in the RS-2477? Mike Tinker was?
Mm-hmm.
And his background is fish and game biologist, right?
No, his background is...
Or DOT?
Over land access.
So
he was DNR?
He just mm-hmm. he had a resources land use background. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Who were some of the other people on your committee that worked on that project?
One group that was very helpful was the Alaska Outdoor Council. Because they could identify hunting and fishing routes that were not particularly medical, or not medical, but official.
Mm-hmm.
Just
customary routes.
Yeah, customary and traditionally.
Mm-hmm.
Was Dick Bishop one of those ones?
Dick Bishop was helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Very helpful.
And then on your group that worked for you, did you have biologists? Did you have historians?
Yes, we did.
Do you remember some of their names?
Well, Dick Bishop, for example, mm-hmm. for fish and game. Sorry, I'm kind of tired today. Yeah. I'm not very articulate.
No, it's okay. We're getting to the end of our time. So, but I didn't want to end in the middle of this subject. So I'm dragging it out. But we can stop and...
Well, one of our chief workers was Joe Sullivan with the DNR.
Okay.
I think he still works for the state in the Department of Transportation.
So it sounds like a bunch of employees already working for the state just took this project on.
Another one was Norm Piipinen. P-I-I-P-S-I-M-A-N, Piipinen.
Okay.
Piispa, an A in there.
Piispa, okay.
But was he DNR also?
He was DOT.
DOT?
He'd done a lot of work in DOT with us.
What about the North Slope of the Arctic? Were there historic trails and routes up there that got included in this?
Oh, yeah.
There were?
It covered the whole state.
Okay.
Yeah. So how long did it take you to do all this? It
took us about 2.5 years.
Do you remember what those years were, what the dates? I mean, I could go look it up, but
no.
When Hickel was governor.
Through 1994. Okay. Be 1992 through 94.
Okay. And the reason this project came about was the lieutenant governor and the governor said, we want this done?
Yes. Well, Jack had been... been educated on the issue
mm-hmm.
over the years because yeah. he'd been involved in so many discussions about
well,
access.
He was involved with the Constitution and state.
And he was, yes, he was very involved he was on the Constitutional Convention. Right. He carried through into, he was in legislature for many years. Yeah. So he was probably the most important advocate anybody should take any credit at all should be Jack Coghill.
Okay. Well, there was an article in the paper last week about a 40-mile case in navigability, but it meant, which is shows it's still going on, but they talk about that DNR has an group called Public Access Assertion and Defense Unit. Mm-hmm. Was that your group, or this is something different?
I think that's the same thing.
Okay.
My group.
That's what it was called, the Public Access Assertion and Defense Unit. Okay.
Public access by land and water. Right. That's what the John Sturgeon case is about, pretty much.
Yeah. Because that's... was in the Yukon Charlie Preserve, and whether he was allowed to use the kind of boat he was using.
Yeah, they said, no, you can't use that. That's land owned by the feds.
Yeah, and it's all, you know, submerged lands and the riverbanks, and it's incredibly complicated.
The riverbed is owned by the state.
Even if it's in federal...
if you can prove that it was used by the public prior to this.
That's what the RS-2477, okay.
And it gets its name from the 1972 Mining Act Amendment, Section RS-2477.
I didn't know that. Cool.
There are a lot of other sections of that.
Yeah. If it's like any other... legislation, they're very complicated with lots of sections.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it was like the D2.
Yeah.
Was the most volatile section back in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a topic for another day, because that's a big one.
Yeah, well, that was the section in the 1971-72 Lands Act.
The Native Land Claims Act. And then it took it into the ANILCA in 1980.
Moved it forward to the 1980s.
Right.
Where they had to settle that issue.
Right.
So we settled the issue. Well, they're still debating it.
Well, it shows the navigable waters they're still debating, too. They're still in court. You know,
it'll go on forever.
The state has sued. They want... access or control over the 40-mile from the feds. So
well, there are a lot of gold mining prospects
up there.
In 40-mile.
Yeah.
And they were proven 40, 50, 60 years ago, produced gold. And miners would go in there to prospect it. And some BLM guy come running in there in his four-wheeler chasing them out.
Well, yeah, I remember there was a case a few years ago that happened.
Yeah, it's happened several times over in the 40-mile river drainage. Mm-hmm. A lot of gold over there.
Yeah,
that's Crystal McQuesten's old stomping ground, right?
It's what?
Crystal McQuesten.
That's her old stomping ground?
40 Mile.
She's born at 40 Mile.
Yeah.
That's the junction of the 40 Mile River and Yukon River.
Okay.
It was a major trading post during the Klondike.
June
21st, 1891.
Cool.
That's when she was born.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
His dad took him out in 1896. Yep.
Well, Mike, you've shared a lot today. I really appreciate it. You've enlightened me on a lot of things.
Well, maybe I could... organize it better sometime.
Well, I think, are we done for today?
I think I'm done for today.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
But I feel like it's just, my comments were so scattered that we might focus on what we talked about today on one project.
Okay, yeah.
But we had the Department of Law involved through judge. He is now a judge, Doug Blankenship.
Okay.
Had DNR involved. We had the governor's office involved. I represented that.
Mm-hmm.
2.5 years, that's a lot of work.
Yeah, I mean, you've represented it to say, yeah, you know.
So well, I've got about 3 file folders downstairs.
You mean filing cabinets?
Or, yeah.
Yeah.
But the original, the Alaska Outdoor Council helped us so much that we, when we copied a file, we had a legal file folder.
Mm-hmm.
It would contain the narrative, a picture, copy of an interview, maybe some tapes of that interview. And that's on file in the lieutenant governor's office, unless they threw it out.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't be surprised. And in doing that, we made copies for Alaska Outdoor Council. And that took, I think, 4 legal file cabinets.
Wow.
Now I have copies of a lot of that.
You mean 4 drawers or 4 actual...
Drawers.
Drawers, yeah. Well, it reminds me...
4 cabinets.
4 actual cabinets.
Wow.
It reminds me a little bit of the work that gets done for Native allotment verification.
Yeah.
That they have to do all this background research and do interviews and show a history of use.
Well, it's legal documentation.
Yeah.
That would stand in court.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Outdoor Council has its collection here in Fairbanks in a vault.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's good that it's been preserved because it was a lot of work.
Yeah, and I made copies of some of the major ones,
mm-hmm.
and I own them.
Right. All right, well, thank you very much for today. It was a lot of details, so it was great. I will turn this off.